Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's time now for the Record program number 373, titled The Ties That Bind, Part 6. This is being recorded on August 19th of the year 2002. A couple of points of information. If the presentation that I'm making sounds pedantic, if it's hard to follow, I can appreciate that. Be aware that within a week or so of each broadcast, there is an article-length, detailed, annotated description of the program on the web, the World Wide Web, in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. In addition, sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. Their website with more recent programs streaming is at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory. And there are older programs streaming at a longer URL linked to both the WFMU website and the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. The Spitfire website is equipped with Real Audio as well, although it is for download only. And the latest pair of half-hour segments is available on the Spitfire website. We're going to be dealing with some more of the environment and the attendant connections on the events in and around September 11th, a very broad subject which is sort of now morphing over into related but distinct areas, such as the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and the potential war, anyway, with Iraq. We will see what happens precisely in connection with that. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article from The New Yorker magazine. This is from The New Yorker of August 5th of 2002. It's called Annals of Crime, an American Terrorist. It's by Ira Silverman. And this deals with a fellow who was born David Belfield and who ultimately converted to Islam. He's an African-American, and he converted to Islam and became an associate of the Islamic fundamentalist regime in Iran under Khomeini. And he converted there. He changed his name rather to Dawood Salahuddin, Salahuddin. He recently turned up as an actor in the movie Kandahar, and it was revealed when he took off part of his costume that this was the same David Belfield, now Dawood Salahuddin, who had assassinated a relative of the Shah and a supporter of the Shah's regime. This is a fellow named Tabatabai, and specifically this was that there are two Tabatabai brothers, and this Ali Akbar Tabatabai, the former press attaché at the Iranian embassy, was assassinated in 1980 by David Belfield, now Dawood Salahuddin. One of the things, the element of this article that we're going to focus on concerns the recruitment of Belfield, now Salahuddin, by Saeed Ramadan, who was the head of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood is a theocratic Islamo-fascist organization founded in 1928 that is one of the major elements in the investigation into September 11th. We've dealt with the Muslim Brotherhood in, among other programs, For the Record 343, and also numbers 350, 351, 352, 354, and 356. Then through 359, as well as 369. The Muslim Brotherhood has a long association with international fascism. However, as an organization, it has tended to oscillate in terms of its affiliations with any particular regime because it is theocratic in nature. They are Islamist totalitarian theocrats. The Muslim Brotherhood have at times fallen afoul of organizations that they had at one time or another supported, such as some of the secular Arabo-fascist regimes, Nasser in Egypt, and now to a certain extent Gaddafi in Libya. Although Gaddafi is a Muslim, he feels that the Islamic clergy's role should be somewhat downplayed in society, and for that specific reason, he is now at loggerheads with the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood loom large in the background of Al-Qaeda, and we've dealt with them in numerous broadcasts that are not only on the annotations for which, the descriptions for which are on the Spitfire website, they also are archived on the www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery website. More about that later in the program. Now, turning into this article, skipping down into this article, Annals of Crime, An American Terrorist by Ira Silverman, again from the New Yorker magazine of August 5th of 2002. We're going to deal with Salahuddin Naeh Belfield's recruitment by Saeed Ramadan, again, the head of the Muslim Brotherhood at the time, and he recruited Belfield, now Salahuddin, in the United States in May of 1975. The Muslim Brotherhood is traditionally Sunni, but they also maintain strong links with various Shiite regimes and were very supportive of the Islamic fundamentalist government in Iran. Turning to Annals of Crime, An American Terrorist, in May of 1975, Salahuddin met Saeed Ramadan, an Egyptian lawyer and Islamic scholar who was the guest speaker at a prayer service at the Islamic Center, a large mosque on Massachusetts Avenue in Washington. Ramadan, the founder and head of the Center Islamique in Geneva, more about the founding of that later on in the program, had been living in exile in Switzerland since the 1950s. Salahuddin describes Ramadan, who was his advisor and spiritual guide until his death in 1995, as, quote, the international point man for the Muslim Brotherhood, unquote. The Muslim Brotherhood, founded in Egypt in 1928, was, according to Salahuddin, the inspiration for almost every militant group in the Muslim world. Ramadan's father-in-law was its founder. That, by the way, is Hassan al-Banna. Either al-Banna or a son, Hassan al-Banna, is listed on the board of directors of al-Taqwa, itself with very close connections to the Muslim Brotherhood. Al-Taqwa later changed its name to Nada Management. It includes in its directorship not only Youssef Nada, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, an alleged spy on behalf of Nazi Germany, and also an alleged supporter of al-Qaeda, but also the mysterious Ahmed Huber, a Schweizerdeutsch, nay, Alfred Huber, who converted to Islam and changed his name to Ahmed Huber. Actually, it's pronounced, his last name is Huber, not Huber. We've spoken about Huber in numerous broadcasts, including most recently, For the Record 371, in which we interviewed Kevin Coogan, the author not only of the book Dreamer of the Day, but also of an article about Ahmed Huber, or Huber, and that is available on the autonomedia.org website. More about the Muslim Brotherhood and Saeed Ramadan's association with Salahuddin. During the summer of 1979, Ramadan stayed with Salahuddin in a house in Washington about a mile from the Howard University campus. They often talked through the night, quote, I don't think another human being, including my biological parents, knew me better, unquote, Salahuddin said. One subject they discussed was Salahuddin's personality, particularly his capacity for violent action. Ramadan, he said, assured him that if he were to commit such an act, he wouldn't be emotionally scarred by it. It would be, quote, accomplished and simply forgotten, unquote. In December of 1979, Salahuddin called Ramadan in Geneva to seek his advice about working for the Iranians as a security guard. It was 10 months after the overthrow of the Shah, and Ayatollah Khomeini, now in power in Iran, was on guard against a counter-revolution. Salahuddin said he remembered Ramadan telling him to do everything he possibly could on Khomeini's behalf. Quote, his tone was emphatic, Salahuddin said, again quoting, and for me, it was taken as a command, unquote. Salahuddin told me that Ramadan hadn't known about his plans to kill Tabatabai, but an article in the Washington Post on August 8, 1980, reported that there were three calls around the time of the murder to Ramadan's Geneva home from payphones near the Iranian diplomatic office. A law enforcement source involved in the Tabatabai case told me that investigators believed the calls were made by a Salahuddin handler, unquote, a Khomeini operative in the United States who was not charged with the murder. The man who recruited him to kill Tabatabai, Salahuddin told me, was, quote, someone in Washington, unquote, who was, quote, passing along instructions, unquote, from the Iranian government. He would not divulge the identity of his contact and would say only that he believes he met him at the Iranian Student Center. Quote, at no point did I advertise myself as a hitman, although it was clear to people who knew me that I had no profound fear of violence or of the authorities, unquote. Salahuddin said that he was given a chunk of cash, unquote, actually $5,000, and 5 weeks to get the job done. And again, Salahuddin denies that Ramadan was involved in the recruitment of Salahuddin for the assassination, but there does appear to be an evidentiary tributary connecting Ramadan directly to the killing, although perhaps through intermediaries. Then Salahuddin went on to talk about his alleged role as a point man for Saeed Ramadan. Skipping down in the article, Salahuddin also traveled in the militant Muslim world as a kind of diplomat for Saeed Ramadan. Quote, I presented myself as Ramadan's envoy, and that was with his encouragement, unquote. Salahuddin wrote that in 1986 he made certain representations on behalf of Ramadan to Muammar Gaddafi, unquote, through one of Gaddafi's cousins, and in 1995 he said he delivered a message from Ramadan to President Barhanuddin Rabbani in Afghanistan, warning him that the Taliban had ties to the CIA. From December of 1986 to May of 1988, Salahuddin said he served in Afghanistan as a soldier with the Mujahideen. But of course, it was during this time period and during the anti-Soviet Afghan war of the 1980s that Al-Qaeda had its genesis. What we're going to do is to review a couple of points very quickly concerning Saeed Ramadan and the Muslim Brotherhood and some of their historical associations with Third Reich elements, in particular in the post-war period. We're going to turn briefly to a book we've used in the past. It's called Dollars for Terror, subtitled The United States and Islam. It's authored by Richard Labeviere. It was published in softcover by Algora Books and copyright 2000 in English. It was translated by Martin de Mer. You can visit the Algora website at www.algora.com, and the ISBN number for this paperback edition is 1-892-941-06-6. And of the relationship between Saeed Ramadan, again, who was a mentor to and an employer, apparently, of Belfield or Salahuddin ne Belfield, we read as follows. The fraternity here is a reference to the Muslim Brotherhood. This pivotal role in the development of the fraternity, played abroad by Saeed Ramadan, was also emphasized by Rifat Saeed, a deputy of the Egyptian left. Quote, before he settled in Europe, he made long sojourns, he is Ramadan, he made long sojourns in Saudi Arabia with King Faisal, then in Pakistan, where he worked with lawyers on the Islamic right. But by the end of the 1950s, he opened a new door by selling the Saudis on the idea of Dawah, i.e. the propagation of Islam, especially in Europe. Thus, he proposed to them initially to open a center in Munich. Why Munich? Why Germany? I asked Rifat Saeed. Quote, because there one finds old complicities that go back to the late 1930s when the Muslim Brothers collaborated with the agents of Nazi Germany. And furthermore, Turkish immigration to Germany had started to become an important phenomenon. By soaking up the savings of these Muslim workers, Yusef Nada, like Saeed Ramadan, took advantage of an extremely favorable context and used it as a springboard for the Muslim Brothers' economic activities. For these various reasons, the Munich Center quickly became very important, unquote, adds the Egyptian deputy. And we've spoken about Yusef Nada, his associations with the Muslim Brotherhood, the allegations by the U.S. government that Nada management, Ney al-Taqwa, was a supportive organization for al-Qaeda, and that support extended after September 11th. And we're also going to review briefly the association, somewhat oblique in this passage, between Saeed Ramadan and Third Reich operative extraordinaire François Janoux, a friend to Hitler, a friend to Carlos the Jackal, an individual whose name crops up in connection with September 11th in a number of different contexts. His lawyer, when he stood trial for terrorism, was the co-chairman of the board of SICO, the Saudi investment company, the European financial branch of the bin Laden economic empire. It was alleged by Ernest Bacchus, a money laundering expert, that financial fronts set up by François Genoux were involved in the securities speculation in the run-up to September 11th. An associate of Genoux's was Jacques Vergès, one of whose law partners is the French counsel for Zacharias Moussaoui. And I would note that François Genoux, whether or not he was involved in September 11th, certainly is connected to the milieu of Al-Qaeda and Islamofascism, and one of the most important historical figures in the Middle East and its association with the Third Reich. François Genoux became a key banker for the Algerian FLN in their war against France in the 1950s, and it was the association between the FLN financial conduits and Genoux and his, that is to say Genoux's presence in Geneva, that led Saïd Ramadan to move to Geneva, where he founded the Centre Islamique in Geneva. That was the center referred to in the article in The New Yorker. Turning once again to Dollars for Terror, let us mention only the incident of the treasurer of the FLN, at the center of which the banker François Genoux may be found. Ramadan and the Muslim Brothers thought that they could play a part in the Algerian process as they had done in Palestine in 1947. Saïd Ramadan thus left Munich to settle in the city of Calvin, that of course being Geneva. So again, note Saïd Ramadan, the fact that in 1975 he apparently became a mentor to Salahuddin, and Salahuddin, who functioned on behalf of the Iranians, became a diplomat or sort of an envoy by his own account for Saïd Ramadan of the Muslim Brotherhood. One of the things that we've spoken about in connection with Islamofascism, in connection with the working hypothesis that I have been presenting, that the underground Reich and its Islamofascist allies were behind not only the September 11th attack, but as we've looked at, there are evidentiary tributaries running between September 11th and a number of other key terrorist incidents in the 1990s. The first World Trade Center attack in 1993, the Oklahoma City bombing, and other attacks as well. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the L.A. Weekly's issue of July 26th through August 1st of 2002. This article by Jim Krogan called The Terrorist Motel, subtitled The I-40 Connection Between Zacharias Moussaoui and Mohammed Atta, alleges a number of interesting things. First of all, it alleges that Zacharias Moussaoui, the alleged 20th hijacker, whose French attorney, again, is a law partner of Genoux protégé, Jacques Vergès, it alleges that Zacharias Moussaoui was at a motel in or outside of Oklahoma City in the company of Mohammed Atta. As we're going to see, most of the evidence, at least the evidence presented in the United States above board against Zacharias Moussaoui, is circumstantial evidence. And we're going to take a look at the allegations that Moussaoui was in fact identified by witnesses as being in the presence of Mohammed Atta at a motel outside Oklahoma City. This would be one of the few hard connections presented above board linking Moussaoui to the actual hijackers. There are other circumstantial tributaries linking them as well. In addition, we're going to note that a fellow named Meneptpa, also an Islamic fundamentalist and a person with a fairly lengthy criminal record in the United States, was an associate of Moussaoui, and that Menepta was spotted at this particular motel outside of Oklahoma City in the run-up to the Oklahoma City bombing in 1994 and 1995. And in addition to the Moussaoui Atta allegation and the Menepta Motel Oklahoma City connection, we're going to note that this very same motel was utilized by Timothy McVeigh and company, allegedly in the company of Middle Eastern men, particularly Iraqis, in connection with the planning for the Oklahoma City bombing. As we've looked at in past broadcasts dealing with Oklahoma City, there is very firm evidence that the plot went well beyond McVeigh and Nichols. One of the key names, Andreas Strassmeier, a German military officer and white supremacist, son of Gunter Strassmeier, Helmut Kohl's chief of staff, and also the architect of German reunification, and the son of one of the charter members of the Nazi Party under Hitler. In addition, there have been a number of evidentiary tributaries linking McVeigh and Nichols with elements from the Middle East, Islamo-fascist elements from the Middle East. A number of witnesses had identified McVeigh as being in the presence of Middle Eastern men, allegedly Iraqis. And as we've looked at in a number of broadcasts, there also appear to have been links between the people connected with the first World Trade Center attack, in particular Ramzi Youssef, and Terry Nichols in the Philippines. In particular, a fellow named Murad identified Terry Nichols as being connected to the abortive plot to blow up U.S. airliners. That plot was co-named Operation Bojinka, which is a Croatian word meaning Big Bang. We looked at that in, for the record, 357 and 358, among other broadcasts. We've looked at the connection between Nichols and the allegations about Nichols' activities in the Philippines in connection with Ramzi Youssef in numerous broadcasts, including For the Record Program 88 and in number 330. We'll be reviewing those later in the program. Now, again, this article is from the L.A. Weekly. You can visit their website at laweekly.com. And this is from the L.A. Weekly of July 26th through August 1st, 2002. It's by Jim Crogan, C-R-O-G-A-N, titled The Terrorist Motel, subtitled The I-40 Connection Between Zacharias Moussaoui and Mohammed Atta. Now, the motel at which allegedly Manetta was seen, Moussaoui was seen with Atta, and Timothy McVeigh was seen in connection with a number of Middle Eastern men, allegedly Iraqis, is worth noting because not only was it the same motel, but Atta and company were taking flight training in Norman, Oklahoma, and the manager of the motel pointed out that there were a number of motels that were very reputable that were much closer to Norman, Oklahoma, and considerably cheaper. But Atta was apparently quite insistent that he and his associates wanted to stay at this particular motel. The article reads as follows. What happened at the nondescript roadside motel outside Oklahoma City was just a fleeting encounter during the twisted cross-country odyssey of the terrorists who would carry out the September 11th attacks. Mohammed Atta, alleged leader of the plot, and two companions wanted to rent a room, but couldn't get the deal they wanted, so they left. It was an incident of no particular importance except for one thing. The owner of the motel remembers Atta being in the company of Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, who was arrested prior to September 11th, and now faces conspiracy charges in connection with the terror assaults. If this recollection is correct, the entire incident and its absence from the public record raises new questions about the FBI investigation of Moussaoui and even the 1995 destruction of the federal building in Oklahoma City. Already, the FBI has endured a withering political and media critique for failing to aggressively investigate Moussaoui and his contacts during his 4 weeks in custody prior to the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Some FBI officials have responded by characterizing Moussaoui as only a minor player. But the report from the motel owner, if proven, could change that. And it also could force the FBI to reopen its investigation of Middle Eastern connections to the 1995 Oklahoma City blast, because convicted bombers Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols reportedly stayed at the same motel, interacting with a group of Iraqis during the weeks before the bombing. At press time, the erratic Moussaoui, who was representing himself, was attempting to plead guilty and bring his trial to a close. The 34-year-old French citizen of Moroccan descent had previously filed some 94 hand-scrawled, rambling motions attacking the government's case and its right to prosecute him. But that circus obscures a conundrum of a different sort. The government's case, as outlined in its new 6-count conspiracy indictment, is largely circumstantial, lacking any definitive link between Moussaoui and the 19 hijackers identified by federal authorities. All of which makes the apparent shelving of the Moussaoui-Atta sighting all the stranger. In fact, even though multiple sources contend that the FBI interviewed the motel owner, there's no indication that prosecutors were told. It's possible that the FBI found the motel owner's identifications wrong or his story unreliable. But it's still odd that in interviews with the Weekly, Justice Department prosecutors seem to know nothing about the motel encounter, especially because agents reportedly told the motel owner they would pass the information on to Moussaoui's defense team. The motel co-owner, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said the incident occurred around August 1, 2001, just 6 weeks before 9/11. Quote, "They came in around 10 or 11 a.m. and started talking to my desk clerk," he said. Even though he was working about 10 feet away from the trio, the owner didn't really pay any attention at first. "They were asking my clerk, who no longer works here, about a weekly rate for our rooms," unquote. The former clerk could not be reached for comment. The motel, explained the owner, sets aside some rooms with small kitchenettes to rent on a weekly basis. But they were all taken, unquote. He said the clerk explained the situation, but the visitors were persistent. Finally, my clerk asked me to talk to them. The motel owner said that Moussaoui and a man who appeared to be Marwan al-Shehhi, who helped crash a jetliner into the South Tower of the World Trade Center, were friendly and said a few things, but Atta was clearly the leader. Quote, "He did most of the talking and seemed very serious," said the owner, adding, quote, "I was standing face to face, about 2 feet away from Atta, and talked to the three of them for about 10 minutes. Atta asked if he could rent one of the other rooms at a weekly rate, and I told him no. I asked him what they were doing here in the area, and Atta told me they were going to flight school. I thought he meant the Federal Aviation Administration training in Oklahoma City, but Atta told me no, they were taking flight training in Norman. I said I didn't understand why they wanted to rent one of my rooms since we were about 28 miles from Norman and there were a lot of reasonably priced motels a lot closer. But he said they had heard good things about my place and wanted to stay there. I told them I was sorry, but we couldn't accommodate them. Atta finally said okay, then they all thanked me for my time and left," unquote. After the attack, said the motel owner, he recognized his visitors in photos from television reports. "I was really stunned," he said. Then he decided to call the FBI hotline. The motel owner said he didn't hear right back from the FBI. In the interim, he also spoke to a former law enforcement officer who was investigating reported sightings of Mujahideen Abulkadar Meneptma at the same motel during the mid-1990s. Meneptma, M-E-N-E-P-T-A, reportedly a friend of Moussaoui, who was arrested 30 years ago in Colorado for aggravated robbery and served more than 3 years in prison. After September 11th, Meneptma publicly defended Moussaoui, calling him a scapegoat, unquote. The FBI arrested him as a material witness and subsequently charged Meneptma with a federal gun violation. He pleaded guilty and in April of 2002 was sentenced to 15 months in federal prison. He was never charged with any terrorism-related crime, but during the preliminary hearing on the gun charge, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agent Jeffrey Whitney testified that a confidential source placed Meneptma, at a meeting of a radical Islamic group in St. Louis, where he allegedly threatened to shoot any police officer who entered the mosque. Meneptma's attorney challenged the credibility of this report in court. A former desk clerk at the motel, a different clerk from the one who reportedly dealt with Atta and Moussaoui, told The Weekly that he remembered Meneptma because in 1994 and 1995, prior to the Oklahoma City attack, Meneptma frequently visited the motel office. There, he bought coffee and talked for hours to this clerk. The clerk and his wife, who both formerly worked at the motel, said they picked Meneptma's picture out of a photo lineup prepared by a law enforcement officer who had interviewed the motel owner. The officer, who also spoke to The Weekly on condition of anonymity, said that after the motel owner told him about the Moussaoui sighting, he contacted a member of the Oklahoma's Joint Terrorism Task Force, which includes the FBI. The FBI finally acted on the tip. The motel owner said that on December 19, 2001, he went to FBI offices in Oklahoma City for a formal interview where he was debriefed by an FBI agent and by Oklahoma City Police Sergeant Jerry Flowers. We're going to talk more about this article and finish the reading of it in the second half of the program. That concludes side one of For the Record program number 373, The Ties That Bind Part 6, being recorded on August 19th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.